The real eye-opener in this case was the opening statement of Richard Hernt, the head counsel for the PMA. He got up and started a long speech. And I will give just the major points of it. Said, Your Honor, in 1919, we broke the Longshoremen's Union on this coast. And there followed 15 years of oppression for longshoremen. In 1934, they reestablished a union, and there followed 15 years of confrontation and conflict between the union and the employer. But in the third period, that began 14 years later in 1948, we saw that the union had become so mature that we could work together. And in 1959, they had come so far that we allowed the union to participate in the recruitment of men into the industry. And in 1963, they had really come so far that we allowed them to participate in the firing of men from the industry. And these men, Your Honor, sitting here as plaintiffs, represent both of those processes. Now, if you rule for them, Your Honor, you're ruling against labor peace on this waterfront. On the other hand, if you rule for us, the defendants, you're in the company of Wayne Morse, of Admiral so-and-so, when he named a bunch of luminaries.
So the PMA lawyer is actually representing the PMA and the union, at the same, the interests of the PMA and the union.
Yes, and they argue jointly like that throughout. Mm-hmm. And they argue their case, for their case, jointly. But he, in absolute class terms, laid it out that because they had created a collaborative relationship, they created class peace on the front, that the judge should rule for them for that reason. And I said to myself, sitting there, how dumb on his part to make that argument. There's nothing illegal about what he's saying. He's making a straight class appeal without talking about any law. He was right. I was wrong.
Right.
About what was effective in that court. It's a fantastic,
especially when the judge is related to the
Getty fortune. Yeah. But next to the last day of the trial, I believe it was, we brought in an ex-PMA lawyer who was the active lawyer on this case for the PMA at the time. And he testified, for example, with Weir. I was told we had to get him. Regardless, just get him. And he explained it in the fact that there was a spame of it. And that Weir's name was Mud from day one. And that judge didn't even open his eye.
Yeah. Well, didn't your lawyer try to exploit those sort of things?
Well, our lawyer was the one who got the guy in the door, because he'd scheduled him there for a long time, but he didn't exploit the situation.
Uh-huh. Well, let's go back to the M&M agreement. In 1959 and 60, tell us about the M&M agreements. What did that do to work on the waterfront and workers on the waterfront? How did it impact you?
Well, we had the...
Or how did it impact this case?
We were working under the work rules created by the 34 Award to settle with the 1934 strike. The 34 Award was an award given by Roosevelt's National Longshore Labor Board in 1934. They, in effect, wrote the contract. They sat there as arbitrators, it's true, but they simply had the two sides come in alternatively and argue their case. then they, the three arbitrators, would write language and get the two sides to sign it. So there was a rolling effect of creating the 34 award, which became the 34 contract. Mm-hmm. Now that contract had a lot of puns in it, like 50% control of the hiring hall by the longshoreman and 50% by the employer, joint control of the hiring hall. It had in it a series of work rules, one of them being the 2,100 pound sling load limit on a man-made load. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
What's a man-made load?
Loads that human beings pile onto a board or a sling, mm-hmm, a net. And but the joker in the 34 award didn't appear until 1957, 58, 59, when the first automation contract, and then M&M in 1960, went into effect. The 34 award allowed the employers to introduce labor-saving devices at will. In 1932-33, there was a fight against the four-wheeler driver and the plasterboard making big load. Mm-hmm. The fight was to keep the two-wheeler.
The two-wheeler, four-wheeler, what are these referring to?
Well, two-wheelers are the two-wheeled dollies.
Yeah.
Now, the four-wheeler is a wagon. They have big iron tongues with iron loops, and you can hook four of them up in a row and have a jitney pull the four under the hook one at a time, and then pull up a little bit, the second one's under the hook, the third one, the fourth one. Before, this had all come under the hook on two-wheel dollies. The guys are fighting to keep employment in 32, 33, 34. That's one of the big fights of men. And so they said, if you will stop fighting this new technology in the form of a four-wheel wagons in a row under each, moving in it, under and away from each hook, you can have this award. So that created the precedent. Then came finally the forklift truck during World War II and so on, which the union's response was, okay, you guys are going to have this increased productivity, give us a share. Give us some of the, what you make out of this. So if you make this, though, when the new technology is going to eliminate jobs altogether, so to speak, or damn near all of them, give us a share, your constituency, the union membership, if you're the leader, has become so small that they can take you on and knock you right out of the box. Mm-hmm. So
when did the union first take this tact of saying, well, if you're going to introduce this labor-saving device, and it's going to produce, and it's going to increase
34, 36, 48, on and on and on.
That element that later became the selling point of M&M, there was already a history.
There's already precedent for all of that approach. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened, of course, to me was the change in the work pace. We were getting loads, for example, at the Encinal Terminal in Alameda, of canned pineapple, for example, Dole pineapple. Mm-hmm. There were 2,100 pound loads. And in the day of the first M&M went on agreement, we were getting 44 and 4,800 pound loads. And in the tween decks, we would land at 4,400 pound load on a four-wheeler, and the four-wheeler would go through the hatch boards, mm-hmm, into the lower hold.
Why did M&M get rid of these weight limits?
Why? Well, here comes all this automated equipment. You're not going to have man-made loads anymore, mm-hmm, so give up these rules. Mm-hmm. But M&M, that is, containers were not mass introduced during the life of the first 6-year M&M. It was under the second, third, and fourth years of the second six-year M&M that containerization was mass introduced, so that we were working the same kinds of cargo in the same way for another six, seven, and 8 years without the work rules of 34, so the productivity went up skyrocketing. So that we were the ones who created the money to invest in the containers.
So they basically...
We financed the containers.
Yeah, by work speed up and job, putting more work on you. Now, did the workers... Workers going along with this, and how? If so, how were they? How were they being sold on this?
Well, the New York, I mean the San Francisco guys. Most of them were Bridges men. They'd go with them. The opposition to that M&M agreement centered in this port.
And meaning the local 13.
Local 13, and they even took job action against it. And they were refusing night gangs to the employer.
What year was this?
59-60. Mm-hmm. I can remember we were working Pedro Cargo regularly in Frisco in 59.
Because they were...
And we didn't know what was happening. Bridges was not telling us that there was a strike down here on the part of rank and file against the new M&M setup was coming. Bridges and the head of the PMA, Paul St. Shirt, came down to this port after having bypassed the port and begun to starve it out for 2 and 3 weeks, and said, we will starve this port out. In effect, they didn't put it that way, but they did say, unless you guys get on the stick again, but what you're going to have to do now to get everything back to where it was, you're going to have to accept this contract, that special contract just for this port. And the guys are still call that the Yellow Dog contract down here. Mm-hmm. That contract gave the employer the right to accuse an A-man of an infraction of work rules without telling the man on the job. And when he would come up to get a job again from that same company, the dispatcher would say, we can't let you go to work this job until you go before labor relations. I said, what for? They said, well, you'll learn when you get there. And they would slap the guy's wrist when he got there, but it was really and truly, you know, now a kangaroo court situation. And these guys voted by a vast majority for that contract in order to get work back into this port. Now, Herman Benson writes about documents that in issue 13 of the AUD's, American Socialist Green Democracy's paper. And I have the copy of the Yellow Dog contract is in that. I have a copy here.
How was, in the first M&M contract, how was the, they sold this to the workers by saying, oh, well,
we're going to take the sweat out of longshoring, was Bridges' line.
But wasn't there a financial
incentive? Said that you will have a weekly pay guarantee, and anybody who wants to retire at 62 instead of 65 will get $7,900 to pay for his pension those first 3 years. That amount of money, $7,900, the way we will use it will pay him his pension for 3 years.
So he wouldn't be.
If you want to work till you're 65, you can have the $7,900 in cash when you walk out the door. They didn't tell him they were going to tax that. There was a big fight about that later because they taxed the hell out of it.
But for the amount of productivity that was produced by the workers, was that?
Well, not one penny was ever used for a weekly guarantee because there's plenty of work. It was used, $7,900, but that was a small amount. What they did with that early retirement was get rid of the veterans of the 1934 strike very quick in one fell swoop, or most of them. And
how much do you think, just off the top of your head, how much was the M&F contract and relaxation of work rules on the docks able to increase productivity for the...
Well, they admitted to 86%. And then our guys in the front judged at least 300.
300%.
Yeah, because the sling load limit was gone. Out the window. Non-existent. Which means also, not only are you carrying heavy loads in, but that means the hook travels fewer times, at least 50% less than it traveled before. The travel of the hook is what gave you a little breather. Okay? So, it keeps you steadily at it at all times.
And the thing was, the hook never stops, huh?
Yeah. So then there's gang sanctity was eliminated in the following way. Gang sanctity was that you want to fire one man, you got to fire the whole gang. Well, the whole gang, not the whole, you have to fire the entire gang. The whole gang segment of the entire gang is the key segment. That's the point of production in the hold. Now, the basic gang on a loadout, loading a ship, is 8 men in the hold. Discharging a ship is 6 men in the hold. The first M&N and the second, and from there on out, the basic hold gang became 4. And they gave you 2 swing men if you were discharging, and 4 swing men in addition to the basic gang and loading out.
The swing men mean they could work where they were needed? Is that okay?
Well, that's ostensibly it. But they weren't working anywhere else. Every gang that was dispatched was still panhandled cargo, was getting 2 or 4 additional men. But you could fire those swing men one at a time. So that shows you how they knew what they were doing. So aware that they were going to bust the back of militancy. The people created the union with the hold men. They're the militants. They're point of production. The members of the union in 1960 are not working in the hold. They're working on deck and on the dock. The men who are the cadres of the hold workers are B-men, non-union, without good representation. What a setup.
Definitely establishing through a tier system. I'm curious, what about the casual system? Did that come into...
No, the casuals all the way up and down the coast was when they needed more than a B-man. They would call up all the unions on strike, or the firemen, or the policemen, and they would get the guys who are not working come down. Well, that was very good for the union, and the union controlled the casuals in peak periods over and above the B-men, and were making friends with all these other people who are on strike constantly by giving them this extra work.
You know,
by creating a casual hall, you eliminate that strength of the union. It becomes the employer and the union's joint hiring hall. And you treat them like shit, and that ain't big friends of the union.
How quickly, after M&M begins, do you notice that containerization? Does it begin to pick up fast, these container ships? Does the nature of the job, besides having bigger slings?
It didn't happen for the entire first contract.
Uh-huh.
M&M 1, it lasted until 1966, and it was 67-68 when mass containerization came in. But the second M&M had a joker, an additional joker in it. With paragraph 9.43, which said that the employer will have the right to hire steady men who are local ILWU men, but doesn't have to go through the hiring hall for them. So, as a result, we had the biggest and longest single longshore strike in the history of the country, the 1971-72 longshore strike on this coast, which was, Bridges came with this contract at 9.4 million. The membership said, take your contract back and get a better contract. He came back with a contract that had the same thing in it. They voted to strike. They voted 96% on the whole coast to strike. Within a month or so, the Taft-Hartley Act injunction was slapped on them for an 80-day cooling off period. They worked for 80 days and voted whether or not they would go back to strike, and they voted 93% to return to the strike, to the picket line. One of the first things they did both times was to pull all the steady men back into the hiring hall, and the morale went up in all the locals. Everybody's coming out of the hall again and feeling good. Bridges comes back with another contract with 9.43 in it, and he finally wore them all down. But that was a big strike. Up and down this coast, suddenly there were no nine. I have the button up. Upstairs, no 9.43 on it. Mm-hmm. And the union did not make those buttons. Rank and filers had thousands of those buttons made on their own.
As a longshoreman, if the company came up to you and said, hey, we want you as a steady man, couldn't you have said, no, I don't want
to? You could say no.
So there must have been some...
Many did.
Yeah.
And finally, you did enough.
It subverted seniority for one thing.
The guys were not interested in doing this by seniority. They were interested in doing this through the by the low man out system. But the employers gave a guaranteed wage to the steady men that was much higher than the plug men who work in and out of the hall. So that a steady man today, without batting an eyelash, just show up, is going to make 70 to 80 thousand a year,
mm-hmm.
and as much as 100.
Yeah.
And that kind of incentive, you will always find enough hungry guys
mm-hmm.
that will bend for the dough. And then the guys who are not getting that much dough are beginning to resent it and say, Jesus, why should we? And it splits the union wide open.